Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. This is Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of medical news, entertainment, debate, dialogue, discussion, and answers to your calls and emails. It's all here on Ask Dr. Dawn. Before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Before we go any further, I thought I would read a wonderful email. It's wonderful, well, partially because of its content, but mostly because of where it was sent from. This is from Greg in North Africa, where I imagine it's probably not raining. If there's one place on the planet, the Sahara Desert is usually a good bet. Anyway, Greg writes, post-polio syndrome and facet rhizotomies, a bad mix? Greg's a 61-year-old man who's 6'4", 110 pounds, and generally very healthy, if a bit beat up by my active life and my emergency service work. I'm now in North Africa on a disaster relief project. When I was sick, I lived in an iron lung for a bit in Boston's Children's Hospital, thankfully with no obvious lasting deficit, or so I thought. You recently spoke of how, as we age, post-polio syndrome presents with a reduction in nerve cells' ability to carry signals. 18 months ago, I exited the world of too much low back pain thanks to a 30-minute procedure where they cooked four of my facet nerves with facet rhizotomy. My questions for you. Do you think my back and leg problem and the polio could be connected? The answer there, I would say, Greg, is probably not. The odds of a 60-year-old man having facet arthritis is, well, easily 2-to-1 in favor. So I think it's just two events occurring in the same body. Question two, they say my nerves will grow back, most likely with the pain over the next year or two. Would it be unwise to redo the rhizotomy? And the data so far say no, this could be done recurrently. And just a little anatomy lesson, this facet rhizotomy thing, the nerve root from the spinal cord comes out through a hole and divides into two sections, a dorsal section and a ventral section, ventral being Latin for the belly. And the dorsal section goes to the facet, which is the hinge joint of that particular vertebrae. And the ventral section goes everywhere else. So when they do a facet rhizotomy and burn the dorsal section, they're being selective. And in skilled hands, the rate of falsely burning the wrong thing is actually quite low. And it knocks out the nerve supply to the area of arthritis. So you don't feel your arthritis. You still have it, but it's the old if the tree falls in the forest. If you have pain but you don't feel it, do you have pain? There is no risk of potential paralysis by repeated rhizotomy. You're not damaging that area, and that's not a consideration, just anatomically not possible. Apparently, Greg continues, I have a little cushion left between my lower vertebrae. My only ongoing symptoms are a lack of feeling on my outer lower left leg and the anterior middle of the same foot and two toes. So that sounds a lot like the fifth lumbar vertebrae, dermatome, that he's describing. And he's concerned because he says that's the same leg the polio hit. And I remember lots of shots. So should I be worried effectively, he's saying, that this pain is a manifestation of post-polio syndrome? And what Greg doesn't tell me in the letter, but which is the distinguishing factor here, is weakness. Polio is a disease of the motor neurons. Those motor neurons run in a particular column in the spinal cord, and that's what polio gets. It does not affect the sensory neurons directly. And so one of the terrible things about polio is being completely paralyzed but still having all of your sensation. Polio is now very rare in the world. It still exists in certain parts of Southeast Asia, but for the most part, it has been thoroughly eradicated in most of the world, particularly the developed or industrialized world. It is still an issue for those people who had it as children. And as that generation gets into their 60s and 70s, they experience progressive weakness, which feels to them like a recurrence of the paralysis. The pain that's associated with it is probably related to imbalances in the in the muscles and the effect that has on joints and other body tissues, rather than directly related to secondary degeneration of the sensory apparatus. So I hope that clears it up for you, Greg, and thanks for the long distance email. It's one of the things I do love about the web. This next email from Leslie, a little closer to home, in Santa Cruz. I'm a 62-year-old woman in good health. 3 weeks ago, I awoke with my lower right lip swollen. Although there did not appear to be a bite mark, I considered it to be a bug or a spider bite. I took ibuprofen, didn't help much. A few hours later, as the swelling gradually subsided, my left lower lip began suddenly to tingle, then it too swelled. Then the next morning, when the lower lip swelled, the upper lip did the same thing. Then it was the upper left lip. I also began to have raised, flat, and very itchy raised welts on my upper torso and inner forearms. I've not ever experienced hives, but this seems to fit the symptoms. The lip swelling seems to be located on the upper parts of my lip, only one section at a time. She goes on in great detail, which I won't share with you, but goes on to say there's no sign of a herpes outbreak or any other kind of sore. Well, thinking that it was bugs, Leslie checked her bedding, and that didn't seem to be the problem, but she did continue to have the swelling on and off over the last 3 weeks. And she continues to get wheals on her forearms and torso that come and go. And she's wondering, what's up with this? If it's not a bug bite, what is it? She hasn't changed anything in her diet, nor have I switched laundry soap or shampoo. I take blood pressure medicine, but not ACE inhibitors, which I understand can cause hives. True. I've taken these blood pressure medicines for at least 10 years with no issues. And she takes atenolol and hydrochlorothiazide. I also take potassium in a fish oil capsule daily. Well, Leslie, first of all, what you're describing is classic angioedema, which is essentially facial hives. On the face, you don't generally get hives. You get swelling, particularly swelling of the mouth and lips. While this can be virally induced, and I have, at least that's what I was taught in medical school. Looking back, I'm not sure what the evidentiary basis for that is, but I'll take it as read that what they taught me was true in this case. But the first thing clinically that I always think about is an ingestion. And in terms of figuring out whether or not you are ingesting something different, the problem with hives and angioedema is that a single ingestion of a compound that you are sensitive to may cause symptoms that persist for weeks. They tend to be cyclic. They tend to be worse at night and in the early hours of the morning. I don't know why, presumably related to your circadian rhythms, but I'm not sure what the mechanism for that is. In any event, the most important bit of advice I can give you here is pay attention once this damps down to the next time, if there is a next time it occurs, because something that you put in your mouth in the last 48 hours was a trigger. It could be that you've developed a sensitivity to a food that you have been eating for a long time. It could be a preservative, a dye. Sometimes it's very hard to figure out. I remember a case where I dealt with two children who were sisters who had hives intermittently, and the mother swore there was nothing getting in around their triggers, and it turned out the neighbor lady was giving them a particular kind of red licorice candy that they were both sensitive to. It took a long time to figure out that the neighbor lady was the one who was varying the diet. It can be very difficult to nail down in the short term. The combination of the over-the-counter children's Benadryl that you were taking and low-dose Tagamet or cimetidine. This is over-the-counter as Tagamet HS. You can also use ranitidine, which is the Zantac product. And these block the H2 receptors in the skin, while the Benadryl and diphenhydramine derivatives get the H1 blockers. Between the two of them, you'll damp down the mast cells, which are releasing all that nasty histamine and causing these symptoms in your skin. This isn't usually dangerous. It can amplify, particularly if you're having repeated ingestions. And so if it turns out not to go away and damp down after several weeks, I would start looking at a drug holiday or switching drugs. And I would take a good look at, did I change brands of herb or brands of generic just before the onset of these symptoms, since some generic compounds contain, for example, food coloring or a dye or something that could be a factor here. One last quick response to David in Santa Cruz. David has noticed a sense of loss of acuity of taste, and he feels like he can smell just fine, went to an ear, nose, and throat doctor and passed the smell test, so it's not a loss of sense of smell. And he can still detect very gross senses of sweet, sour, and bitter, but he doesn't feel like he's got that nuancing. David, I would suggest you try a zinc supplement. There are a lot of people who are borderline zinc deficient, and if they go just a little past that border, one of the first things that is commonly seen is a erosion of the sense of taste. So zinc supplements for a couple of weeks might just do the trick. If that works, please do email me and let me know so that I can brag a little bit on the air. And I want to talk a little bit about some healthcare and science in the news. First of all, one of the larger stories that came out this week was a study published Tuesday in the New England Journal of Medicine looking at lowering the risk of AIDS in people who had a risk because of their sexual practices. The study looked at 2,500 men in six countries, Brazil, Ecuador, Peru, South Africa, Thailand, and the U.S. They were looking at a drug called Truvada, which is a combination of tenofovir and intricitabine. One too many syllables in there for me. Anyway, Truvada is an expensive drug in the United States. It would cost about $12,000 a year to take a pill every day. In poor countries, generics are available on a compassionate needs basis for 40 cents a pill. Of course, 40 cents a pill in a poor country is still a fair amount of money per month and per year. And so while this is nice information, it doesn't necessarily get to the root of the problem as far as HIV. It is, however, a big deal to know that if you take your pill every day in that subgroup of the people who got the free medication, it was 90% effective. So I think where it would really be useful is in couples who are serodifferent and in individuals who are at risk because of their sexual practices who do have adequate funding support. Bottom line is that if you can prevent one case of AIDS, and 90% is pretty darn good, then you've saved the system a lot of money in the long run, because at least in this country, if you get AIDS, you do get therapy, and the therapies are not curative, but they definitely prolong your life enough to make you a cost consideration. So prevention may turn out to be cheaper than treatment. And before we go to our first callers, I want to really underline something that's going on in the dentistry world. Orthodontics is big money. Everybody wants to have their kids' teeth be straight. There's a lot of dental insurance out there. And right now, the dental industry is in the process of being sold large number of expensive machines in their private offices, which they are going to be incentivized to use in treating children's teeth. This could be a very, very bad thing because these beams are CT scanners. They provide really pretty, beautiful computer 3D design pictures. They're fun. They're cool. They're Star Wars. Yeah, but they're also a big, big radiation dose. And many children who are getting orthodontic work are getting 4, 5, 6 scans in the course of a year. And the radiation dose of these scans is quite significant. We're looking at a great deal of variation in dental x-rays in this industry to start with. I'm going to put your dirty laundry out there, dental industry, but I started refusing dental x-rays quite a while ago routinely after reading that the variation in the amount of radiation that one could get from dental x-ray from one office to the next was up to a 500%. That's a fivefold difference in radiation. And some of this just has to do with the fact that they're using old developing chemicals. Most x-ray, dental x-rays in this country use a slow x-ray film that requires more radiation. There's no good reason for that except it's a little bit cheaper. And while dentists are absolutely trained to be completely and absolutely paranoid about cleaning your teeth if you have a heart murmur, they are not trained to be paranoid about radiation exposure, and they routinely expose people to radiation at levels above what would be considered safe if you were talking to a radiation expert. And it's done routinely, and it needs to be stopped. Instead, what we're seeing here is an amplification. So I want to bring your attention to this article. It's a reprint from the New York Times. You can get it on the New York Times website. The author is Bogdanich and McGinty. And its date is November 22nd. Anyone who wants to call up and educate me about radiation, I'm just a humble family practice doctor, and I'm not a physicist, but the idea that we are doing this on growing children to get their teeth straight when other technology exists strikes me as an idea that needs pushback, and needs pushback pretty darn soon. By the way, those of you who do need dental x-rays, you should be looking for a dentist who uses digital x-ray technology that is available, at least in this community, fairly widely. And you should make it your basis for whether or not you're going to allow x-rays to be done, because it is literally a tenth of the amount of radiation exposure. Let's go to Vince in Capitola. Hello, Vince, and welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dr. Don.
Good morning.
I had just got my second osteoporosis exam 2 years apart. So for 2 years, I've been trying to do a non-prescription approach to this with D and calcium and vitamin K, things like that. So on one, I had on my AP spine, I actually got my bone mass up 1.9%, but both of the hips went down 5.1% and the other one 7.8. So they're, and it puts me in two of those numbers.
Okay, Vince, let me ask you a couple questions. First of all,
I should give you the T-score.
Well, yeah, I'll get to that, but are they on the same machine?
Yes, went to the exact same place. Yes.
And they didn't change machines. That's important.
As far as I know, it looked identical to what I was on before.
Okay, well, somewhere on that report, the machine is stated using such and such a machine. So make sure that it's on the same machine so that we're talking apples and apples. Now, what were those T-scores? Total T-score for the hip.
Total T-score for the hip was, well, they have like comparison from last time. So for the hip, this time it was negative 2.6, and before, 2 years ago, it was negative 2.3.
All right. That's just at the edge of where we start calling osteoporosis, which means that the risk of hip fracture is increased. Now, risk factors. How old are you?
60.
Do you have a family history of a first-degree relative, brother, sister, mother, father, having either spinal or hip fracture?
No.
All right. Do you drink?
No.
Okay. Did you use steroids, such as steroids for asthma or for any other disease process for a prolonged period in your life?
No.
Okay. And you've not had any fractures yourself?
No.
So my first question is, who got your DEX in the first place and why? Because it's not typical to do it in men.
I started having a lot of bone pain in my joints, and the doctor that was treating me at the time decided to check different things. And
And turned you into a person with a disease now.
Well, he.
Yeah, because now you're worried about this.
Yep.
And you have two issues, your pain plus this. And by the way, there's no way this was related to your pain.
Well, they did find that I have a total degeneration of one of my discs and L1, L2.
Like I said, that has nothing to do with your pain.
Right.
The osteopenia, or now osteoporosis, in your hips is not related to your back pain. So they went and found something, and now they're probably pressuring you to go on a bisphosphonate drug.
I'm sure they're going to try that again. I've already stopped them. I said, give me 2 years and see if I can do it with diet and exercise, jumping up and down and walking, things like that.
And you checked your vitamin D levels, and those are okay.
It came in at around 45 or 46, and I'd take about 3,000 IUs a day.
Okay. So 45 or 46, we're not looking at failure to mineralize or failure to absorb. The next thing I would do is, first of all, the difference between a 2.5 and a 2.3, that is to say a 1.9 increase in the spine, is less than the limits of resolution for the test. So we don't really know you improved in the spine.
Okay.
With a level of a 5% difference over a couple of years, that does sound like deterioration.
Yeah.
So one could make the argument that you need to do something more or you're going to progressively lose bone.
Right.
It's important for you to go and get your FRAX score, F-R-A-X.
F-R-A-X.
F-R-A-X, capital letters. Just put it into a search engine, and you will be taken to a website that will let you calculate your FRAX score, which gives you which now should be and is becoming rapidly the standard of whether or not we treat, that use of monoclonal antibodies to prevent diseases that don't yet exist, which is what you are. You're a person with a risk factor. It's debatable whether you actually have a disease.
I agree.
Using drugs that we know can perhaps contribute to the development of cancer and cause severe infections in order to maybe prevent you from getting a disease, not a really smart move, not a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think that you need additional evaluation from a bone metabolism expert, and I don't know if you're seeing someone who is versed in that. We have a couple of nephrologists who have made a special study of bone metabolism. There's the Stanford Center for this if you're local, and those are places that you might think of going, having your parathyroid hormone looked at if that already hasn't been done, and measuring your urinary output of bone proteins that will be recycled if you're in bone balance and be elevated if you're losing bone, to try to see what's going on here. And your kidney function is probably key in terms of what's maintaining this progressive bone loss. It really does require an expert. Should you go on a bisphosphonate at this point, just in case? You know, that's where the FRAX score comes in. It's the wisdom of large numbers. If you take hundreds of people and you study these parameters, you figure out who's the high-risk group, and that's where the risk-benefit favors using the drug. And it's a much better criteria than just using a raw T-score. So go get your FRAX and do the other things I talked about there.
And this bone metabolism expert, that's a nephrologist, did you say?
Well, yes. Bone metabolism expert will have been a nephrologist first.
So I could look up just bone metabolism expert would get me somewhere, huh?
I think I'd start there. See what you get, enough. You know, put in your area. Expertise in bone metabolism in Santa Cruz County or wherever, whatever county you're in.
Great.
The other thing is, like I said, go online and get that FRAX score because you may be fine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no family history, male. I think you're probably not at significant risk for a fracture unless you're, you know, skiing or something.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Don.
Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Let's talk a little bit, since we just had Thanksgiving, talk a little bit about fruits and vegetables and let you know about a new report. Pesticides in fruits and vegetables turn out to be a fairly big issue. And a study is a kind of a snapshot study, but it was looking at what percentage of food in children that were in their diet contained pesticides. And in total, the researchers found 14 different pesticides. These were published in Environmental Health Perspectives. The concept that I want to leave you with here is that some foods are more likely to have pesticide residues than others. The nonprofit group, the Environmental Working Group, has a list of vegetables and fruits that are most likely to have pesticide residue, so therefore those are the ones that you should buy organic when possible. It's kind of a difficult list to remember, so I do encourage you to go to my website, AskDrDon.com, and you'll find several links to the Environmental Working Group, the fish oils page, for example. From there, you can link to the home page of Environmental Working Group and look for that Dirty Dozen. I'll read them to you. Celery, peaches, strawberries, apples, blueberries, nectarines, bell peppers, spinach, cherries, kale, potatoes, and imported grapes. So, strongly recommended that you go to that website, put that in your shopping list, things that are, oddly enough, not likely to be contaminated: avocados, asparagus, kiwi, mangoes, pineapples, cabbage, cantaloupe, watermelons, grapefruit, sweet potatoes. So it's a list. There's no way to re-derive it mentally. You just have to write it down and carry it around. But I do strongly recommend, if you have small children, that you try to buy, for example, organic apples. Because of the pesticide issue, that you try to buy organic strawberries and blueberries. And those are fruits that kids will eat. And I really encourage you to make sure that they are a large part of your children's diet. Well, let's go now to Dave in Boulder Creek. Hello, Dave. Welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing?
We got you. Hi, I'm fine.
I just want to let you know I really, really enjoy your program. I look forward to it every Saturday morning.
Well, thank you.
So here's my problem. I got a tick bite a couple days ago, and I got the tick out, but it has become, the tissue surrounding the tick bite has become pretty infected. It's very red and swollen and painful. And I've had serious tick reactions before, and obviously it's a holiday weekend, and so I can't just call my doctor and come in. So I'm wondering, do you think that I should go to the emergency room to get antibiotics?
What's the timing here of the development of the inflammation?
Let's see, it was Thanksgiving morning. So Thursday morning, I woke up with this sharp prick. It's in my stomach, actually. I woke up with this sharp prick, and there was a tick, and so I pulled him out. And so it's been, let's see, Thursday, Friday, today, Saturday. It seems actually to be not as bad today as it was yesterday, but I'm really paranoid about Lyme disease.
Well, okay, let's start with that then. It's too soon for it to be a Lyme disease reaction.
Okay.
That's really, really, really fast.
Okay.
It's actually a little early to be even like a staph infection, which would be one of the quicker, staph or strep, or the quick bacterial infections, wound infections, you know, cuts and bruises that get infected. And that's typically more like 48 hours to get rolling.
Wow.
And especially if it's like a little bit better now, where it's in the time frame for is in a hypersensitivity reaction. In other words, you woke up, it was already irritated and stinging. It's like the histamine lady that we were talking about earlier who had the swelling in her mouth and the hives.
Mm-hmm.
There are several different levels of reaction, but think in terms of something intermediate between hives and a bee sting hive reaction and a mosquito bite reaction.
Okay.
People do develop sensitivity to the components in the tick's saliva, and they'll typically have irritation and itching within 12 hours of the bite. And it'll amplify and peak roughly at 2 days and then start to back down.
That's kind of exactly what this is doing.
Right. So that's why I'm saying I think you have a hypersensitivity reaction. And you're right. It's a Saturday. You'd have to, unless your doctor has an urgent care hours, you'd have to go in. And clinically, I have to tell you, you can't tell by looking unless there's pus whether or not it's an infection or a hypersensitivity reaction because
okay.
The body's vocabulary for these two reactions is the same. It's redness and swelling and heat.
Okay.
So sitting tight for 12 hours as long as it seems to be improving is, I think, a prudent thing to do. It's a reasonable thing to do. If you could get into your doctor's office and have them look at it, they almost certainly would give you antibiotics to hedge their bets. And, you know, my attitude is don't use antibiotics unless you really think the person needs them or there's exceptional circumstances, although I'll acknowledge I get my arm twisted all the time for unnecessary antibiotics, and
okay.
I just do the due diligence informed consent and then hand out the prescription because I'd like to see that patient back again.
Okay.
You could probably sit tight on this given that you were having irritation right away.
Okay.
And that doesn't fit with infection. For information, the Lyme's rash is not irritated, it's not sore, it doesn't itch, and it is essentially, it looks like a sunburn, but it doesn't hurt.
Okay.
And people don't generally even know they've got it unless they see it. But they're like, whoa, I feel fine there, but I've got this pink target lesion. So yours doesn't sound anything like a Lyme reaction.
Okay.
One last thing on the Lyme reaction. Most people who get documented Lyme disease didn't feel their tick bite and didn't see a rash.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, the reason I'm so paranoid is because I have a neighbor who got Lyme disease about 5 years ago, and she is still a mess.
Well, I will tell you that we're working on an interview about how many people who think that they're a mess because of Lyme disease actually may have other infections, but we'll talk about that probably coming up in the next month or so. We're working on producing that show.
Okay. I have another comment to make about radiation.
Go ahead.
I worked for 17 years in a nuclear weapons plant back when I was a foolish Republican, which I no longer am. I just want to make that very clear.
You're in recovery. You know, one never really stops being a Republican when one is merely in recovery.
Okay. So anyway, we received lots of training, and one of the fundamental things that they taught us was that there are two possible reactions to radiation exposure. Number one, the cell can get stronger and fight the radiation, or number two, the cell can die. So it's dependent upon the constitution of the individual.
Okay. Well, the cell getting stronger, fighting the radiation, sounds like macho horse poop that they told the employees as a propaganda measure, and I want to see the science behind that.
Okay.
Basically, what happens when radiation goes through your body is it either misses the DNA or it hits the DNA. If it hits the DNA, that DNA is disrupted. Then along come the little repair mechanisms that fix the disruptions. And mutations happen constantly.
Right.
We adapted here on this planet. We've got cosmic rays. We've got ground radiation. We adapted ultraviolet. We've got all this stuff hitting our DNA. And we adapted to be able to repair a certain number of events per minute or events per second. Some people are born with bad DNA in the sense that they don't have good repair mechanisms, and those are those families where everybody gets some kind of cancer by the time they're 50. Some people are really good at repairing DNA, and when you have something like a Nagasaki or a Hiroshima, the people who don't get cancer and who live 50 years after that event, those were the people with the good repair. That's what that is going on. What we have really right now in our understanding of radiation and its effect on cells is a very inadequate understanding of rate and volume. So, you know, you hear something like, well, it's background radiation, so it's, you know, one CT scan is 9 months worth of background radiation, as if background radiation was coming in at the same speed that the radiation from a CT scan is. It's not. So what we don't understand is where we blow through the repair threshold on the average individual. Statistically speaking, the more radiation you receive in a shorter period of time, the more likely you are to show up with cancer down the line from those mutations that induced that you didn't have enough time to repair. To get back around to what they told you at your job, I don't think that's true.
Okay.
And at this point, you're how far out from that job?
Well, probably 15 years.
Okay. So you don't smoke and you avoid future mutations and you should be good.
Okay.
Because, you know, essentially the latency period for radiation-induced cancer is about 10 years.
I remember working with a lot of those people. A lot of them did have skin cancer things going on, and then a lot of them didn't. So that kind of, for me, confirmed the theory that, okay, some people are more or less immune and others are not.
No one's immune. It's a matter of exactly how much damage can you take and repair per unit time.
Okay.
I mean, if I stuck you at ground zero, or if I stuck you, not ground zero, obviously you'd vaporize, but you know what I'm saying. If I hit you with a massive dose of radiation that didn't kill your bone marrow, the bets are you would get cancer.
Okay.
But you're past worrying about that now.
Yeah. It's just an interesting topic to me, and I was kind of glad that you talked about it this morning. So
what I really wish is that I knew what to tell people about, for example, these scanners that they're now putting in the airports. You know, it's not a big risk. It's the chest x-ray risk. But what if you've just had two CT scans because you're a cancer patient and you've been through chemo, which we know is mutagenic, and radiation therapy last year, and now we're doing a CT scan to make sure that you're still okay, and then you're going to travel. And it's like, wow, you know, when do we cross that threshold for body repair?
Right.
You know, what I'd love to do is be able to look at people and even stratify their risk. You're high risk, you're low risk, you're medium risk.
Oh, right. Well, I'm kind of fascinated by the fact that I spent 17 years, basically when I was a very young person, I started there when I was 20. I spent 17 years in what was dubbed the most dangerous building in the United States. And, you know, here I am 25 years later, and wow, things are great.
And you don't have cancer.
No.
So that's great.
Yeah.
Pass that DNA along.
All right.
We need it. The genome needs it, okay?
All right. Thanks a lot. Have a great morning.
Bye-bye. And let's go to our next caller, and that is Simon in SoCal. Simon, you're on the air.
Good morning, Dr. Don.
Good morning.
I know you've talked about this before, and it's kind of like asking the direction to the Holy Grail, but is there any unbiased site where I can find out about the real efficacy of herbaceuticals? Ginkgo biloba, palm nuts, whatever.
Yeah, there is. It's called the National Library of Medicine. And essentially what you have to do is you have to be scientifically erudite enough to work your way through actual medical literature. Because if you go looking online and search by the herb, you'll get people who are trying to sell it to you.
Absolutely.
And you'll get people who are trying to debunk it because it threatens their practice model or their product line.
Shall we talk Big P?
Well, yeah. I mean, Big P funds a lot of studies that then do inadequate doses of something to show that, well, inadequate doses of fish oil don't prevent heart disease. It's like, okay, thank you very much. That doesn't surprise me. Let's try adequate doses and see what it does. You know, what gets on the front page of what gets published, by the way, because there's publication bias, but also what gets on the front page of the New York Times is, you know, study shows fish oil doesn't prevent heart disease. And then you have to actually read the methods. Google has a beta site called Scholar, which just searches the medical literature and excludes anybody who's got anything to sell. It's a little bit like drinking from the fire hose in the sense that there'll be things on there that are lab cell culture. You don't care about cell culture. You care about things done in rodents. You care about things that might be done in humans. You care about epidemiologic studies a little bit. But what you really care about is animal studies using surrogate markers or using animal models for disease. And then the question is, well, what am I looking for from this drug? Because in science, of course, we can only isolate one variable and do science on that. So if we're looking for cognition in ginkgo biloba, we're going to look at, you know, how fast does the rat run the maze? And then maybe you'll find a study where they compare ginkgo biloba to caffeine on the rats and find that they run the mazes better on the ginkgo than on the caffeine.
So if that's the only effect you're looking for.
Yeah, but when you're looking for multiple factors, science doesn't do that well. Because the first step is to isolate all other variables and then just have a difference between whatever it is you're trying to test.
Now, I was wondering, Germany seems to have the longest history of them.
The Commission e-monographs, right. And I bought a very nice compendium of that translated into English 25 years ago. And I'm sure there's an online or a CD or something you can get.
Could you give me that again?
The Commission E, capital letter E, like E for environment, monographs. And this was funded by the German government, which has a good healthcare, you know, national health system. And they were looking at what's the data, what are the active compounds, what's the science. And they put it all together into a series of really excellent monographs. That's a great place to start in terms of what's known about the properties and the things that get extracted so they can be studied.
Yes.
And that gets you a good start in terms of efficacy. Like I said, if you want an unbiased site, you have to go to the science, which means that you have to be able to interpret it yourself.
Well, I think actually the Commission E is something that was what I was looking for.
Good.
Yeah.
Good.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We were talking about cancer and radiation this program, and I mentioned the mutagenic properties of chemotherapy. This is something I had hoped to have a chance to talk about, and lo and behold, created my own opening for it. This is a real issue for people who are adult survivors of cancer. Most people who have survived cancer, who had chemotherapy in childhood, Hodgkin's disease, leukemia, central nervous system tumors, most of these people are not getting the kind of monitoring they need. Now, you can find out what is required by going to www.survivor-shipguidelines.org, and I will post that link on my website. For example, little known fact, a woman who was treated for Hodgkin's disease needs to start mammograms at the age of 25. Some people say 19 because the risk of secondary cancer is huge. 21% risk for breast cancer in female survivors of Hodgkin's lymphoma who were treated with radiation. Let me say that again. If you had Hodgkin's and you got radiation and you're a female, you have up to 21% risk of breast cancer. You need surveillance early. And if your health insurance will stand for it, you should be getting MRI screening beginning 8 years after treatment or at the age of 25, whichever comes last. Other types of surveillance are also very important. Survivors of childhood radiation should get colonoscopies every 5 years. They should also get an annual thorough skin cancer. Remember what our guy who worked at the radiation plant said about skin cancer? Skin cancer, being the most common cancer, is, surprise, surprise, the most common cancer among cancer survivors. There are over 11 million Americans out there who are cancer survivors who are not getting extra surveillance as they should be. So it's not just the childhood, although because children are more vulnerable, the need is even greater for them. So this is a call to arms to doctors, nurses, healthcare professionals. As you run across people who have that distant history of childhood cancer, make sure that they know that they have special surveillance requirements that are not probably being met. Let's go to Robert in Ben Lomond. Robert, thanks for waiting.
Hi, doctor.
Hi.
A couple calls ago, you almost answered my question, and that's, how should I feel about the airport scanners? I do a fair amount of flying. I fly like a few trips a year, and I've had plenty of x-rays in my life, and If you're talking about it being equivalent to a chest x-ray, are you talking about digital or photographic film type?
Well, the problem is that when you take a look at estimates of the amount of radiation from a chest x-ray, what you find is a tenfold difference depending on the machine, which means our data stinks. It's as simple as that. We don't have good data. So a lot of it has to do with, again, this idea that how much can your body absorb and repair? So there is no single good answer for this. I'm going to approach it as follows. When I am not late for my flight and can request to be screened, because you are allowed to opt out of this and take a pat down, I'm going for the pat down until I know our science is better than it is, because our science isn't good enough to answer this question right now. It's as simple as that. There's too much variability, and our old data where we've tried to look at this is contaminated by the fact that different radiation levels for those x-rays mean that the data is all muddled on the x-rays in the first place. Overall, there's a rule, which is that absence of evidence is not the same thing as evidence of absence. And we have an absence of evidence that this is harmful, but that's not the same thing as evidence that it's harmless. That's really not the same thing. And, you know, there's a political aspect to it as well, as far as I'm concerned. I sort of resent this intrusion. I don't think it's keeping me safe. I think that, but that's a whole different conversation. It's not really my purview to talk about that. But I do think I can encourage people just to say, look, say no to dental x-rays unless you've got a toothache or you've got some actual reason for needing them. They're a profit margin for the doctor, but that doesn't mean you have to do it. Think about not getting scans unless you need them. And if your doctor can explain to you and justify their use, then that's a good thing. What would happen if I didn't get this test? Would you treat me differently? Very good answer. Very good question, rather. Who knows whether the answer will be any good. With the results of the scans in your situation, if I were flying monthly, I would consider an x-ray once a month, plus the radiation, the cosmic rays, et cetera, I'm going to get at 30,000 feet to be a risk. So what I would probably do is pay the $150 a year to get my retina scan so I can have my little card and bypass all of that.
I didn't know I could do that.
Yeah, there's an outfit. I think they're still in business. They were in, last time I went through San Jose Airport, they were there. And, you know, you pay them a fee, a couple $100 a year, and you get a major security check and you get retina scanned. Then they just scan you. And if you're on the in the database, off you go.
Well, that'd be handy for me because I carry a lot of strange stuff with me and I'm subject to the random,
exactly.
Random pat down. More than one.
Right. So just plan on getting patted down or go get enroll in the service and, you know, pay your money to go to the head of the line.
That's well, I don't mind getting patted down. I just kind of don't like to get too much attention from those people because, like I say, I carry strange stuff and I've been singled out.
Well, let them single you out, smile, do whatever the nice man with a gun tells you to do, except walk into the machine.
Right. Okay. Well, that's a good answer. That's what I wanted to, that's the way I was leaning.
All right. Well, you have my support.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And now, Helen in Scotts Valley. Hello, Helen.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I have a question that I think might be a common one right now. I have a cold that's been very persistent. It's into 3 weeks now. And I've heard that other people are having them, and they're just hanging on and on. And I'm wondering if there's anything further to do. What I've been doing is Sudafed and Robitussin and some nasal rinses. And is that about it? And you just tough it out from that point on?
Well, typically what I'm doing is looking at symptoms. Yes, you tough it out and you do symptom control where you need it. And if you've got a runny nose and the rims of your nose are sore from blowing it all the time, it's like, okay, maybe some cream or some Vaseline on the surface of your nose at night. And you just try and, as you said, tough it out. There's a lot of harm done, particularly for older people using Sudafed. And you mentioned that drug because pseudoephedrine raises your blood pressure, or it can. It rather depends now on which Sudafed you're taking since what with the methamphetamine epidemic, we've now got all sorts of things called Sudafed that actually don't have any decongestants in them. So bottom line is single ingredient cold medications targeted at your symptoms are better. There's some data that antihistamines help dry you up. So if you're really runny, you can use them if you need to for comfort. I'm very fond of a Chinese herb called Yin Chao, Y-I-N, capital Q-I-A-O. And I find that very helpful for my own physiology for cold symptoms. And one of the reasons, it's purely anecdotal, folks, it's not scientific, but I can tell when it wears off because my symptoms come back, and it definitely isn't curing me. It's symptom control.
The yin chao is symptom control?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
In my opinion, at least in me, I think it's symptom control.
Yeah.
All right. I hope that helps.
Thank you very much.
Just be careful you don't hurt yourself with some of these over-the-counter medications. They're not all that safe. When one gets above about 60 and starts to be on multiple medications, I think it's a little bit risky.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. We had an off-air question before we go to our next caller. A few weeks ago, you mentioned that Band-Aids that allow light to get to the wound is good, but I can't find any. Actually, it's not light, it's air. And the dressings that allow air to get to the wound, well, let's see, there's one called Clear Strips or Clean Strips that's made by Johnson & Johnson, because I have some of those kicking around in my drawer in the dresser at home. And they typically have a thin, almost saran wrap or clear plastic wrap-like quality, and that will allow air to pass. And it's, you want air to get to the wound a little bit, but you don't want it to dry out. You want to keep it moist. So you really want something that absorbs or transmits water, allows for a little bit of air. Light is really not an issue. You don't need it one way or another. And generally, along with light comes dryness and moisture loss, which is definitely not good for wound healing. Let's go to Marion, and we'll try again. Hello, Marion. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Dr. Dawn.
Hello.
I have a functional medicine question. The specialty labs have these extensive blood panels and urine panels and stuff that are meant to check for nutritional and metabolic functioning.
Right.
And I wondered, you know, I know that you practice functional medicine and I've heard you recommend some of the testing. Are there certain tests that you think are not going to give you valuable information? Like if you're testing amino acids or, say, minerals in the blood, is that giving you more short-term information, or do you think that that's going to tell you the person's physiology over a period of time?
Well, that's a very, very big question. So, Marion, let me try to parse that out a little bit. First of all, the basic idea between functional medicine is that people are not turned out in a cookie factory. And therefore, there's a lot of variation, and all of the science is backing this up. You know, a couple of weeks ago, we talked about this idea of copy number variation and how people may have one copy to 500 copies of a certain gene in their body and how that can influence how strongly or weakly they respond to a drug or how good or bad they are at repairing radiation damage, for example. For every single physiologic process you can think of, there's a variation in the population. So people might be good at absorbing vitamin A and bad at absorbing vitamin D across their small bowel, which would mean that in this individual, they need extra vitamin D, but you don't want to give them extra vitamin A because they might get toxic. So measuring the levels of nutrients in the body, that's one of the reasons you might do functional testing. A lot of times I ask myself with functional medicine, am I thinking prevention here or do I have a problem to solve? And then that guides my choice of tests, because you can easily get mired down in the minutiae of all of the individual physiology of the patient, and you can flood them with a bunch of recommendations, so many recommendations that it's not really humanly possible to follow them all. And people will only take so many pills, even if they're supplements. In my observation, it's somewhere around 7 to 10. And after that, people just get sick of taking pills and stop. And there are the extremely dedicated who will take 20 or 30 supplements a day, and God bless them. But, you know, when I'm trying to ask that question, am I treating a disease? Am I've got some kind of chronic pain or person's fatigued all the time and I'm trying to solve a problem, I would do one battery of functional testing. If they had ADD or difficulty concentrating or depression and they didn't respond to antidepressants, I'd be doing a different battery of tests. And I'm still learning. I'm still feeling my way here in functional medicine. I think most of us are, because the field is just expanding exponentially. So I'm very careful to use Occam's razor before I order the test and say, what are the questions I'm trying to answer here? Because if I get the whole battery, I get bogged down and I don't know what to tell the patient. And I can't fix everything in their physiology, nor do I need to.
Right.
Right? If you're asking about prevention. Let's flip it. There's nothing wrong with you, but you want to make sure that your nutrition is optimum. Then doing tests like the organic acid panel, which looks at your basic energy and basic neurotransmitters and says, you know, are you making enough? Do you have evidence that you're lacking nutritional cofactors? You know, that's a test to consider. If you've got mental health or cognitive issues, amino acid testing is a good thing to think about.
And you think that it's really showing how the person's functioning over a period of time. It's not just showing what they ate the day before.
They generally give you a set of dietary restrictions to stay within before you do the testing, because if you eat a large amount of turkey, for example, it's going to drive your tryptophan levels up for a day. So they do have some restrictions, and you're right, that can complicate things. Again, this testing is expensive, so ideally what we'd want is we'd want three tests to take a look at the results and see if they were stable over three different weeks, and then go with it. But that's running into, you know, $500-$600 just to get the testing, and most people can't afford that.
Yeah.
So I think this field is in its infancy, and it's still really finding how we can do this on a large-scale basis. But at the moment, I think it's very promising, and the testing that I'm most interested is looking at genetic testing. And I'll try to get you more information on that. But you know what? I've run over my time, and we need to get to the news.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.